Good afternoon. Sedejte se, prosím. Děkuju. This is the third panel on transitional justice. We're going to have another one after the break. I'm going to moderate the panel. Each speaker will have 15 minutes. When it gets to around 13 minutes, I'm going to start making obscene gestures. When we reach 16 minutes, my wife gave me a frying pan. So without further ado, please, first one. Sorry. Witold? Please.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Kulesza, family name. Let me present Polish experience about dealing with the past in German language. Strafrechtliche Aufarbeitung des kommunistischen Unrechts, polnische Erfahrungen. Der polnische Gesetzgeber hat ein Jahr nach dem politischen Umbruch, der 1989 zustande gekommen ist, eine Rechtsgrundlage für die Verfolgung der kommunistischen Verbrechen geschaffen. Im Jahre 1991 wurde die Hauptkommission zur Untersuchung von Verbrechen gegen die polnische Nation zur Führung von Ermittlungsverfahren in Sachen der stalinistischen Verbrechen, die durch kommunistische Funktionäre bis 1956 begangen wurden, gesetzlich befugt. Seit 2000 führt die Kommission Ermittlungsverfahren in Sachen der kommunistischen Verbrechen, die zur Zeit der kommunistischen Macht, das heißt bis Ende 1989 in Polen, begangen wurden. Die Hauptkommission besteht seit 1945 und beschäftigte sich mit der Verfolgung von Hitlerverbrechen, die während des Zweiten Weltkriegs in Polen verübt wurden. Die Kommission ist ein Teil der Staatsanwaltschaft und beschäftigte früher mit Hitlers Verbrechen. Heutzutage beschäftigt sich über 100 Staatsanwälte, die über historisches Wissen verfügen, dank dem sie die Nazi-Verbrechen mit den durch stalinistische Funktionäre in Polen begangenen Verbrechen verglichen konnten. Es wurden Dokumente bekannt gegeben und publiziert, die belegen, dass kommunistische Behörden, die seit 1944 auf den vor der deutschen Okkupation befreiten polnischen Gebieten tätig waren, Verbrechen gegenüber denen begangen haben, die während des Krieges Kämpfer der Widerstandsbewegung waren. Die Verbrechen wurden durch Funktionäre der Sicherheitsorgane verübt, die die Mitglieder der Organisationen, deren Ziel der Kampf mit den deutschen Okkupanten war, verhafteten und folterten, sowie durch Staatsanwälte und Richter der Militärgerichte, die bei der Verurteilung zum Tode für die Zugehörigkeit zur Heimatarmee, Armia Krajowa, und zu anderen patriotischen Organisationen mitgewirkt haben. Die erste formelle Rechtsgrundlage für Todesurteile stellte das im Jahre 1944 erlassene Dekret über den Schutz des Staates dar, das eine solche Strafe für die Zugehörigkeit zu einer illegalen Organisation vorausgesehen hat und dessen Vorschriften mit Verstoß gegen Elementargrundsätze der strafrechtlichen Verantwortlichkeit, darunter auch gegen das Rückwirkungsverbot, angewendet wurden. Als eins der vielen Beispiele gilt die Verurteilung zum Tode von zwei Mitgliedern der Organisation Bauernbataillonen durch das Militärgericht im November 1944. Die Mitglieder der Organisationen waren mit den deutschen Okkupanten kämpfende Partisanen. Sie wurden dafür von polnischen Richtern verurteilt, dass sie 2 Monate vor dem Erlass des Dekrets über den Staatsschutz der Organisation angehört hatten, die dann durch die kommunistische Macht für illegal gehalten wurden. Genauso wie zur Zeit der deutschen Okkupation haben polnische Militärgerichte für das Hören des Rundfunks aus London, den Waffenbesitz oder Besitz von Flugblättern mit patriotischem Inhalt Todesstrafen verhängt. Der Vergleich der Urteile der polnischen Gerichte vom Ende 1944 mit den durch deutsche Polizeigerichte gefassten Urteilen 1940 im Rahmen einer außerordentlichen Befriedungsaktion ist schockierend, weil sowohl zur Zeit der kommunistischen Macht als auch früher unter der deutschen Besatzung das Ziel der Gerichte in der Extermination der Polen, die für fähig zum Widerstand gehalten wurden, bestand. Eins der zahlreichen Beispiele, die die Grundlage für derartige Vergleiche schaffen, ist ein durch das polnische Militärgericht am 5. November 1944 gefasstes Todesurteil für einen 30-jährigen Lehrer wegen, zitiere, die Angehörigkeit zu einer illegalen Organisation, deren Ziel der Schutz der demokratischen Verfassung des polnischen Staates war. Zitat Ende. Das in einem Satz ausgedrückten Urteil wollte das Gericht nicht einmal durch einen Hinweis begründen, um was für eine illegale Organisation es sich handeln sollte. Mit anderen Worten stellen sowohl deutsche Polizeigerichte als auch polnische Militärgerichte ein Werkzeug zur Liquidation der polnischen Intelligenz dar, weil sie Todesurteile in Akten der totalen Willkür und in Anlehnung an Vorschriften, die ein gesetzliches Unrecht im Sinne von Gustav Radbruch dargestellt haben, gefällt haben. In Jahren 1944 bis 1956 wurden fast 5000 Todesurteile gefällt, von denen über 70% vollstreckt wurden. Circa 100.000 Personen zur vierjährigen Freiheitsstrafe wegen Verbrechen gegen den Staat verurteilt wurden, zu denen auch politische Vize gezählt wurden. Für feindliche Propaganda wurde unter anderem die Aussage, dass, zitiere, sich die versprochene russische Wurst als Betrug erwiesen hatte, Zitat Ende, gehalten und den Autor der Aussage erhielt eine Strafe von 10 Jahren Gefängnis. Nach 1956 erfolgte ein derartiger Rückfall des Stalinismus nach der Einführung des Kriegsstandes im Dezember 1981, obwohl man dabei bemerken muss, dass die strengste Strafe für die Fortsetzung der Tätigkeit in der verbotenen Organisation Solidarność die Freiheitsstrafe von 10 Jahren war. Das Funktionieren des Terrorsystems hat sich zur Zeit des Kommunismus auf Sicherheitsorgane gestützt, deren Funktionäre diejenigen verhaften, die sogar für potenzielle Gegner der totalitären Macht gehalten wurden. Die Foltern dienten zur Erzwingung der Aussagen, die dann zu Grundlagen für die durch Staatsanwälte verfassten Anklageschriften und für die durch Richter gefällte strenge Urteile waren. Mit der im Jahre 1991 begonnenen Verfolgung der kommunistischen Verbrechen umfasste man in erster Reihe Funktionäre des Sicherheitsdienstes, von denen bis heute mehr als 100 für körperliches und psychisches Quälen der Gefangenen verurteilt wurden. Über 300 wurden verdächtig und angeklagt. Bei den strengsten verhängten Strafen handelte es sich um die Freiheitsstrafen von 5 bis 6 Jahren und die Vollstreckung der Strafe mancher Verurteilten wurden bedingt eingestellt. Unvorstellbar grausame Methoden, die durch angeklagte Funktionäre während der Ermittlungsverfahren angewendet wurden, haben die Zeugen beschrieben, die diese Foltern überlebt hatten, und die Aussagen wurden durch Gerichte für glaubwürdige Beweise für verübte Verbrechen gehalten. Dabei soll darauf hingewiesen werden, dass keiner der Angeklagten gestanden hatte, dass er während des Ermittlungsverfahrens die für Verbrechen gegen die kommunistische Macht verdächtigen Personen gefoltert hatte. Viele Geschädigte könnten ihre Verfolger, die als Beamter der Organe der politischen Polizei sich falscher Namen bedienten und deren Aussehen sich mit der Zeit verändert hatte, nicht erkennen. Dies war eine der Ursachen für die Einstellung von Strafverfahren in Sachen dieser Art. Wegen der Vernehmungen durch die Funktionäre und aus Mangel von ausreichenden Beweisen wurde keiner der Täter der Tötungen während des Ermittlungsverfahrens verurteilt, obwohl solche Fälle tatsächlich stattgefunden haben. Solcher Fälle halber, in denen das Opfer die Folter nicht überlebt hatte, hat der polnische Gesetzgeber eine Möglichkeit der Gewährung den ehemaligen Funktionären des Status des Kronzeugen vorgesehen. Das Gesetz garantierte die Straflosigkeit für denjenigen, der an der Tötung der Verhafteten teilgenommen hatte, wenn er die Mittäter nennt. Trotz dieser Garantie gelang es sich nicht, die ehemaligen Funktionäre dazu zu überzeugen, dass sie im Strafverfahren in der Rolle eines anonymen Kronzeugen auftreten, die Mittäter bei der Begehung des Verbrechens nennen würde. Eine Mauer des Schweigens im Milieu der ehemaligen Funktionäre der kommunistischen politischen Polizei hat sich als stärker erwiesen als die gegenseitige Loyalität der Mitglieder der gegenwärtig tätigen Gruppen der organisierten Kriminalität, von denen manche den Status der Kronzeugen in Anspruch genommen haben. Die Bedeutung von einigen tausenden Ermittlungsverfahren, die gegen Funktionäre der Sicherheitsorganen des totalitären Staates durchgeführt wurden, beschränkt sich nicht auf die Zahl der Verurteilten für grausames Quälen der Verhafteten. Im Rahmen dieser Ermittlungsverfahren haben die durch das kommunistische Regime Geschädigten ihre Aussagen gemacht, die zum ersten Mal in ihrem Leben die Möglichkeit hatten, vor einem Staatsanwalt davon zu berichten, was ihr ganzes Leben zu einer Trauma gemacht hatte. Manche Aussagen waren Berichte über Erlebnisse der Opfer des Unrechtssystems, über die sie früher sogar ihren nächsten Familienmitgliedern nicht erzählt hatten. Ihre Aussagen verhalfen, ein vollständiges Bild des Unrechts und Methoden der Verwirklichung der kommunistischen Ideologie in allen Bereichen des sozialen Lebens in Polen zu rekonstruieren. Dank den Ermittlungsverfahren und der darin gesammelten Dokumentation kann vor allem die junge Generation das Wissen des kommunistischen Systems und die Ursachen seines Umsturzes wie auch den Sinn der Umwandlungen, die nach 1989 zustande gekommen sind, sowie die Bedeutung des Systemgarantien für Menschenrechte besser kennenlernen. Für ein ungelöstes rechtliches und moralisches Problem soll die Verantwortlichkeit der Richter und Staatsanwälte für die Teilnahme an Gerichtsverbrechen, die in Verurteilungen zu sehr strengen Strafen der mutmaßlichen und tatsächlichen Gegner der kommunistischen Macht bestanden, gehalten werden. Weder Richter noch Staatsanwälte wurde in Polen für die im Dienste des totalitären Staates begangenen Verbrechen rechtkräftig verurteilt. Im Grunde genommen wurde angenommen, dass die Richter, die in politischen Prozessen zu strengsten Strafen verurteilt hatten, weder Bewusstsein noch Vorsatz hatten, dass sie ein Unrecht begehen. Eine Minute. Wenn dem Richter nicht beweisen kann, dass er absichtlich rechtswidrig Urteile gefällt hatte, dann ist die Möglichkeit seiner strafrechtlichen Verantwortlichkeit für die ungerechte Verurteilung des Angeklagten ausgeschlossen. Obwohl nach dem Umsturz des Kommunismus in Polen nur ein Teil des Unrechts der Vergangenheit strafrechtlich beurteilt wurde, war dies für die Schaffung der Rechtskultur des seit 1989 neu gebauten Bürgerstaates notwendig. Danke.
Dziękuję. Aus Deutsch auch, Bertolt. Umfried from the University of Vienna will speak about dealing with the GDR past as a second German dictatorship, their commissions of inquiry on the German Democratic Republic in the German Parliament.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me. The structure of my contribution shall be as follows. I'm giving some words on truth and reconciliation commissions as instruments of transitional justice. Then I pass on to an evaluation of the structure and the institutional frame of the commissions of inquiry of the German Bundestag, of their methods, expertise and political decision-making, then on their main outcomes, the main results, and if there's time left, I shall discuss the question if we can call them a European example of truth and reconciliation commissions. I begin with a short overview on truth and reconciliation commissions. These commissions sprang up first in Latin America in the course of regime changes from dictatorship to democracy, first in Argentina in 1983. Their function was to discover the truth about crimes of the past regime and to make proposals for the compensation of the victims of this regime. Today, truth and reconciliation commissions are active all over the world and have become a sort of standard instrument of transitional justice. We can very roughly distinguish two models of such commissions. First, the Latin American model was probably from the Comisión de Verdad y Reconciliación in 1990-1991 in Chile, that the generic name of Truth Commission was coined. These Latin American commissions essentially were to find out the truth about the fate of victims who often had been made to disappear by the repressive forces of the dictatorial regime, and to elaborate guidelines for their rehabilitation and compensation in view of reconciliation within the new regime. The second model is the South African model. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the 1990s in South Africa added an important moment to the Latin American experience. It put less emphasis on compensation than on truth-telling. Truth-telling on the side of the victims as a sort of speaking out of the truth of the sufferings they endured, and on the side of perpetrators as a means to benefit from amnesty if they spoke out and acknowledged the truth about their deeds. Victims and perpetrators were confronted in sometimes traumatic sessions. This is essentially a para-judicial process, telling the truth about their evil deeds, their crimes, and ideally, but not even necessarily, repenting these crimes in front of their victims may entitle perpetrators to amnesty. This is an alternative for a procedure of criminal law. Historical evidence has shown the difficulties and shortcomings of prosecutions of political mass crimes by criminal law. And the South African model was an effort to deal with this issue in a new way. Within the constraints also, you don't have to forget this, within the constraints set by the political arrangement between the representatives of the old and the new regimes, because also in South Africa, as we know, there has been no revolution, it was a sort of negotiated transition. The commissions of inquiry in Germany, they were called Enquete-Kommissionen. Since the first half of the 1990s, a new notion had been created in the effort to conceptualize the new instruments of regime transition in Latin America and South Africa, and probably where we find the most profound changes in Eastern Europe. This was the notion of transitional justice. We can distinguish the following main elements of transitional justice in Germany after reunification, 1990. First, criminal trials against individuals held responsible for crimes of the fallen regime. Second, reprivatization taking the form of restitution of nationalized property. Third, compensation for victims of the GDR regime, a series of laws of rehabilitation and compensation for victims of the regime of the German Democratic Republic. Fourth level, the screening, lustration, of individuals in view of their employment in public positions and also in the private sector. The responsible body was the so-called Gaukbehörde, named after its first chairman, the Reverend Gauck from the German Bürgerrechtsbewegung, the German Civic Movement. This is a sort of publishing agency of the personal files of the state police revealing the truth about its collaborators. And the fifth level, and I'm essentially concentrating my contribution on this fifth level, is the establishment of an official version of the GDR past, the elaboration of a regime of remembrance, certified by experts. And to accomplish this last task, the Parliament, German Parliament, took the initiative and installed two commissions of inquiry, called Aufarbeitung von Geschichte und Folgen der SED-Diktatur in Deutschland, Working Through the History and the Consequences of SED-Dictatorship in Germany, and Überwindung der Folgen der SED-Diktatur im Prozess der deutschen Einheit, Overcoming the Consequences of SED-Dictatorship in the process of German unification, in the first and second half of the 1990s, respectively. And this was by far the largest enterprise of this kind concerning a Soviet-style past. And it was also the first experience regarding to the past in Germany. Commissions of inquiry are a usual instrument of the German parliament to generate experts' advice. But as we know, such a forum had never before been established concerning the past. There has been no such forum concerning the National Socialist past after the fall of National Socialism, for instance. It seems perfectly appropriate that the Parliament, as the elected representative body of the German people, engages in the establishment of a version of the past with the aid of specialists. This recent and still highly active past could, of course, not be left to historians alone. This is a political question. But this enterprise had, by its very nature, strong biases from the beginning. Delay in the composition of the commissions which followed the party constellations in the German parliament. Not only the political members of the commissions, but also the experts, the permanent experts, were nominated by a party logic. And the final reports of the commission were established by a logic of votes and separate votes, which were determined by party majorities. So this is not a logic of scientific work, but this is a political logic. Despite its huge historiographical effort, which was enormous, these two commissions were thus essentially no historiographical enterprise. The task of the first commission was, in the words of its chairman, Reverend Eppelmann from the GDR opposition movement, who had passed to the Christian Democratic Party, CDU. It's a quote, to contribute that those forces which were organizing the oppression of the people in the GDR never again shall get a political chance, thus contributing to the establishment of a democratic consensus and to the internal unification of the Germans. Another quote, political moral assessment of the SED dictatorship and the strengthening of the anti-totalitarian consensus in Germany was one of the explicit main tasks of the second commission. And this is evidently a highly normative political setting. The structure of the commissions, I distinguish three levels. The commissions had a political framing, the parliament, and the conservative liberal majority of the parliament at this time. Second, there was the field of the permanent experts, Sachverständige in German. Together with the politicians, they formed issue-orientated working groups and commissioned external experts, a large number of external experts, to give advice on closely defined thematical sections on the GDR past. They wrote the reports. These reports and expertises formed the larger part of the about 30,000 pages of documentation published by the two commissions, which stand like a massive monument for the contribution of the scientific experts. The third level were testimonials, public hearings with about 300 witnesses, Zeitzeugen in German. This was a means to generate additional sources by capturing voices of the communicative memory of the GDR. These were mostly victims of the GDR regime, but also some representatives of the GDR regime. And this was even more importantly a residuum of the initial conception of doing justice to victims of the old regime by giving them the opportunity to publicly speak out their endured injustices and sufferings. I will come back to this if there's time.
No, there isn't.
Okay. As it is the purpose of a commission of inquiry, the reports resumed in advice for an appropriate course of political actions, Handlungsempfehlungen, in such different fields as appropriate representations of the GDR past, or, for instance, victims' compensation laws. Outcomes, what were the main outcomes of the work of this enormous work of these two commissions? First, they drew an outline of a landscape of memory for a unified Germany, where the GDR got its place as the second German dictatorship. Second, not only chronologically after the first one, the National Socialist one, but also secondary in its scope, importance, and the degree of its evilness. This was consecrated in the so-called Faulenbach formula, named after its author, the social democratic historian Bernd Faulenbach. I quote, because this seems to me a very important moment in coining a new form of remembrance, integrating the new victims, the victims of the GDR. The problem was how to position them in relation to the victims of National Socialism. Position them on the same level, or is this National Socialist experience beyond comparison? And this historian found this very smart formula, quote, "National Socialist crimes must not be relativized by the confrontation with crimes of Stalinism. And Stalinist crimes must not be belittled in reference to National Socialist crimes." At an analytical level, this is not very helpful, because in history, everything is relativized, because put into relation as it would be a religious dogma, but as a political formula, it's very useful. Because a main zone of conflict was between the victims of the two regimes, the victims of the National Socialist regime and the victims of the GDR regime.
Right. So,
and another important outcome, the GDR not only had to adopt the Western German political system, but also the Western German main forms of remembrance. That means that Wiedergutmachung as a leading concept replaced anti-fascism as a leading concept. Because, as you remember, the both German states had placed their legitimacy on their specific ways to react on the to draw the lessons from National Socialism, build up an anti-fascist state in the German Democratic Republic, follow a politics of Wiedergutmachung and Vergangenheitsbewältigung, coming to terms with the past in Western Germany.
Thank you. And what was left unsaid about the German tradition will be said now by Christoph Schäfgen, who will talk about dealing with a non-democratic past in Germany.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the invitation to tell you how Germany has dealt with a non-democratic past. Reunified Germany had decided against an amnesty and for the prosecution of the crimes committed by the communist regime in East Germany. The systematic prosecution commenced in October of 1990. Until the year 2000, it was continually accompanied by a debate of whether to continue the proceedings or whether to put them to a halt. However, Germany did not change the course taken in 1990. On the one hand, the utilization of the criminal law was viewed to be indispensable when it came to the success of the process of reunification and the formation and consolidation of trust in Germany as a state governed by the rule of law. On the other hand, it was clear that the criminal law alone could not fulfill these expectations. Consequently, aside from the criminal proceedings, the government took measures to rehabilitate and compensate the victims and to pay compensations for the suffered losses of property. Of great significance was the political historical dimension in dealing with the past. Parliament not only set up a commission, but also established a special office that by law was required to prioritize the historical and political issues over any legal questions. This office houses the files of the state security of the former East Germany. Public servants were screened for collusion with the state security with the help of these files. The office also provides access to the files to people who were affected by actions of the state security, as well as to the media and academics. It thus contributes to the uncovering of the past. Criminal law played an important role in dealing with the injustices. However, it did not play the main role. Injustices of many kinds were committed in East Germany. Highest attention was paid by both the public and the prosecutor's office to the killed and injured refugees at the inner German border by shot and mines. At least 265 most young people were killed. Several hundred were critically injured. Another focus lay on the legal assessment of the actions by East German criminal courts, in particular taking into consideration the crimes of perversion of the law, manslaughter, and illegal imprisonment. It is estimated that between 150 and 200,000 people were convicted and imprisoned in East Germany because of their opposition against the political system. Capital punishment was pronounced in 72 cases and carried out in 52 cases in political matters. Conviction that became known to the authorities led to more than 50,000 investigations. Most of these dealt with the harsh convictions of people who had tried to flee or who had publicly expressed their wish to leave the country. The third major complex of investigations circled around the practices of East Germany's secret service used in eliminating political enemies in East and West, such as killings, abductions, spying, eavesdropping, the controlling of mail, and the subversion of certain individuals. Other crimes cannot be discussed in the course of this presentation. Now I am going to address the legal situation in Germany. For lack of regulations to the contrary in the Treaty of Unification, the Prosecutor's Office and the Courts of Reunified Germany had to prosecute and punish these state crimes in the same way as regular, everyday crimes committed in Germany. According to the Treaty of Unification, the prosecution of East Germany's state injustices required that the criminal acts, that is, the killing of refugees or the imprisonment of opponents of the regime, were criminal under East Germany's laws at the time. This provision was necessary since Germany's constitution provides that the person responsible for a certain act can be punished only if the act was defined by law as a criminal offense before it was committed. Prinzip of nullum crimen sine lege. Moreover, there was no explicit exemption from this principle for the crimes committed by a regime that was based on injustices. The prohibition of retroactivity forced the German courts to apply a legal order that was alien to them and that was based on a completely different grasp of the law and its function. This caused many legal difficulties. This presentation can discuss these problems only briefly and only with regard to the prosecution of the killings at the inner German border and the injustices committed by the East German judiciary. The Federal Supreme Court in criminal matters ruled that the intentional killings of refugees at the border to prevent an escape constituted murder according to the laws of East Germany. At the same time, however, the killings were justified under the same East German laws and under East German state practice. Thus, according to the laws of East Germany, the persons responsible for the killings could not be held accountable. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court did not acquit the perpetrators. There were two reasons for the court's decision. First, the written law of East Germany allowed for a different interpretation of the law. That is, they could be read to give priority to the protection of human life and not to the aim of preventing people from fleeing East Germany. Second, the Supreme Court was of the view that the statutory justification for the killings, as East German understood the prevention of escapes, could not be validly applied. It was irrelevant to draw on this ground when assessing the killings, since it obviously violated fundamental ideas of justice and obligations of humanity. The court ultimately based its reasoning on the fact that the right to life is of paramount status in the international community, that a state can interfere with this right only in exceptional circumstances, and that the killing of people with the sole aim to prevent their leaving the country is in violation of this value system. The jurisprudence of the court that has the protection of human rights prevail over state sovereignty was groundbreaking and may well provide guidance in future situations where the use of violence is legitimized by the state. Since the legalization of the killings of the refugees contrary to human rights law, East Germany law could be disregarded, the persons responsible could and needed be punished. The convicted personnel's appeals the Federal Constitutional Court and later to the European Court of Human Rights were rejected. Neither court accepted the appellant's argument that the criminal courts were in violation of the retroactivity prohibition. And now to the assessment of East German judiciary. The prohibition of taking a person's life, common to all civilized nations, required the courts to accept the death sentences handed out by the East German judiciary only if they addressed the most serious crimes and the most serious forms of criminal culpability. In all other cases, the nullum crimen principle did not allow for the prosecution of judges and prosecutors for their involvement in proceedings lacking due process standards. The Federal Supreme Court acknowledged that the political provisions which the convictions were based on were not compatible with the human rights of freedom of living, the country, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom of association. However, the court ruled that the violations of these rights did not amount to such an intolerable degree that it would allow to disregard East German statutory law, since the aforementioned human right did not possess the same level of fundamental significance as did the inviolability of human life. Consequently, when assessing the jurisprudence of East German from a criminal law perspective, political norms of East Germany's criminal law had to be treated as valid law, even though from today's view they were unjust. The punishment of East German judges and prosecutors was thus limited to cases where the decision taken was a manifestly illegal, that it could be viewed as arbitrary. Hence, there were only few convictions, 181 persons were convicted. Some few statistical figures. East German state crimes were addressed over a period of 15 years. Academics have estimated that around 75,000 investigations were initiated against approximately 100,000 people. Most of these investigations, more than 97%, were ultimately discontinued. The number of actual accused was 1,737, not more than 750,000. three accused were finally convicted. The aforementioned figures should be disregarded when evaluating the work of the criminal courts and the prosecutor's office. The relatively few convictions do not allow for the conclusion that Germany failed to adequately address the East German state crimes. It must be stressed that the criminal prosecutions were the right thing to do. They were the expected reaction to serious violations of human rights. Moreover, many victims of the old system expected justice in the form of criminal prosecutions. Still, the trials were of great significance from a criminological political perspective. The domestic prosecution and punishment of East German state abuses aimed at proving Germany's legal order to be of worse. It was general prevention in the widest sense. Injustices must be marked as such, and it must be clear that it was not just the course of history or a certain system and power structures that carried out these injustices, but rather individuals who were responsible. There is no impunity for high officials and those who act on the order of the state. The punishment of serious human rights violation is also an imperative of fundamental justice. One minute.
Very quick.
To resolve the prosecute East Germany's crimes and the subsequent decisions by the courts have been subject to criticism of various reasons. I name some: Nietwort, Victor's justice on the one side and concealed amnesty on the other side. I come to the end, and I think the following things will nevertheless remain permanently in the public conscience. Firstly, Germany's criminal justice system honestly attempted to address all forms of communist injustices in the former East Germany. It was always guided by principles of fairness and due process. This will be acknowledged as a major legal achievement. Secondly, the most serious crimes of the killing of the border by which the communist East German regime showed its true human, inhuman colors could be prosecuted and punished. And thirdly, the present legal situation is inadequate. Currently, people who live under totalitarian rule are only accorded protection under the criminal law against state interference with the right to life. This situation remains unsatisfactory and should be to us an incentive to work at its advancement. Thank you.
Punktlich, wunderbar. Okay, the last paper in this session is by Lilia Topozova, who is Canadian of Bulgarian descent. She's both a historian and a filmmaker. She is the writer of the documentary film The Mosquito Problem and Other Stories, which premiered at Cannes and received the Human Rights Award at the Sarajevo Film Festival in 2007. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for the invitation to the Institute, and thank you all for listening to the presentation in advance. And I'll try to be brief, just to give us a little bit more time for discussion afterward. My paper is titled Reckoning Justice, Prosecuting Communism in Post-Communist Bulgaria. And I'm going to examine the Bulgarian initiative post-1989 to criminally prosecute individuals responsible for crimes committed in Gulag-style camps on the territory of Bulgaria. And in particular, I'm going to focus on the figure of one of the defendants, Yulia Rezhgeva, a former camp guard. Despite her brief employment in the camps and her rather low-ranking position in the camp hierarchy, Rajkiva is arguably one of the most infamous persons to emerge from the Bulgarian forced labor camp system. And I believe that her story, more distinctly than that of the other defendants, embodies the complicated legacy of the camp past, and hence my decision to investigate it in more detail. So in this way, in addition to looking at the Bulgarian exercise of post-communist justice, I also want to cast some light on the character trait, personality, and motivations of a rank-and-file perpetrator. I have divided my presentation in three sections. First, I'm going to look at a little bit the historical context. What was the Bulgarian Gulag? Then I'm going to go and look at the trial immediately after 1989, and just to mention, it was a failed trial for past political crimes. And in the third section, I'm going to look at the court testimony as well as the personal testimony of Rajkiva, and I'm going to quote a little bit of what she said to you. And I'm aware that I'm just looking at a single case study, and that, of course, cannot be emblematic of the entire problem of dealing with the past in the former socialist region. However, I think it addresses an important way in which Bulgarian society has attempted to come to terms in this past. And a particular dilemma, I believe, emerges that has also emerged in other instances of transitional justice, and that is, namely, the Bulgarian government's attempt at retributive justice after 1989. The desire to establish guilt or innocence has not always coincided with the search for historical truth. And, of course, that leads us to a larger question that I would like us to address during the discussion, and one addressed most recently by historian Hilary Earle. Does a trial necessarily promote historical truth? Or, as scholar Michael Mayers has argued, perhaps trials cannot be expected to teach history because the goals of punishment and education are completely incompatible. I use the term gulag to refer to the Bulgarian camps. Now, of course, this comes from the Russian acronym of the administrative organization gulag, now long closed. But it has come to designate the entire system of repression and forced labor, not just in the Soviet Union, but also in the countries of the former Eastern Bloc. The history of the Bulgarian gulag has yet to be written. It's a long history that doesn't just take into consideration the camps, but also the prisons, camp settlements, deportation, exile villages. All of these were part of a large penal network which existed from 1944 until the mid-1980s. And, of course, camps were not in operation throughout the entire period, and the system went through many cycles and changes. In tracing back the establishment of the Bulgarian camps, we have to consider the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Interior, and not the Ministry of Justice. Prisons were administered by the Ministry of Justice, and camps were administered by the Office of the State Security, or the so-called secret police. And, of course, the Communist Party seized power in Bulgaria on September 9, 1944, and immediately the State Security Office was given the authority to take the necessary measures in, quote, securing the safety of the country in the face of hostile elements, end of quote. What this indicates is that campsites existed. Individuals were interned there even prior to the passing and adoption of an actual decree, which was done eventually in the beginning of 1945. The euphemistic term for the camps translates in English loosely as a labor correctional community. And once the government received the actual order, camps spread very quickly. The first camps were located in different villages, but eventually they were solidified into two main camps. So just to give you an idea, in the coming years, these gulag model forced labor camps and prisons produced a culture of terror and silence. Between 1944 and 1962, in a country of 8 million people, spread over the territory of about 110,000 square kilometers, there were close to 100 of these camps. The number of people who passed through the camps is very contested. Estimates range from 23,000 to 186,000 to over 500,000. And how many perished in the Bulgarian Gulag has never been determined. So in piecing together the different shreds of information, one is left with a rather scattered and at times conflicting depiction of the past. And that is not surprising. What these discrepancies in figures and in numbers indicate is that the inquiry into the camp past has been very insufficient. And, of course, that insufficiency has led to many problems. So in the lack of any serious inquiry, this is what we know. We understand that these camps existed. And also very much by the admission of the Bulgarian Communist Party in 1962, the regime of them was unbearable and harsh, and allegations of atrocities and abuse surfaced within the party, and they were closed down, the harshest of them in 1962. However, what we don't know, we didn't know in 1989, and we still don't know today, is the following: why the camps existed, how they functioned, who administered them, who ran them there. And of course, the consequences of this gap in knowledge became a very serious challenge once the Gulag crimes came to the legal realm. And this happened immediately after the collapse in November 1989. One of the first revelations that grabbed the public consciousness in Bulgaria was about the torture. Reports of graphic torture sort of captured public opinion. You know, for a short while, survivors became the heroes of the day. And equipped with scattered evidence and pressed by public outcries for justice, the Bulgarian government embarked on a complicated trial for past political crimes, and ultimately a sentence was never passed. Now, the trial began in 1990. It was completely discontinued in 2002. The main reason being that the murders in the camps were treated as regular murders and not under the rubric of crimes against humanity. And therefore, if they were treated as crimes against humanity, of course, there could be no temporal limitation. At the end, there was a bill of indictment that surfaced, and evidence was found for only 14 of these murders. And one of the accused was the actual woman that I want to talk about a little bit now, Yulia Rajgeva. She was put on trial along with the deputy minister of the interior and one more male guard, as well as the head of the camp. When I interviewed the prosecutor, Attorney General Ivan Tatarchev, in 2003, he told me that if it were up to him, they would have all received the death sentences. In a way, he didn't need to do that because, well, the deputy had died in 92 under house arrest. The former deputy minister died in the summer of 93, a month after the trial began. So the only charges that were laid were against a male and a female guard, Rajgeva being one of them, and they were both detained for 3.5 years during the duration of the investigation. By the time I met Yulia, I had heard much about her and read a lot of the sensationalism that came in the papers, a vermin, a beast. So I was a bit curious to meet this beast and this vermin, so to speak. And what attracted me to her story was that, unlike the other transcripts of the trial, she was actually very honest about what happened in the camp, and she was the only defendant, in fact, to disclose her personal involvement in the violence practices of the camp. And so she told me, as soon as I learned that they were looking for guards, I decided to apply. I never thought it would be a scary place because so many people from my town work there. And besides, I really liked my uniform. I had never had such nice clothes before. She described her job in both camps as very severe. She said, quote, "I had to guard women, supervise their labor, and make certain they fulfilled their quota. When the inmates did not carry out their quota, I hit them with a stick, but not a big one. These were my orders. I was told that these women were the scum of society and they were sent here for heavy labor. They gave me a small stick, a wooden one. My bosses had bigger clubs and they were better made. The women made me my stick," she said. "I don't remember dead women during my shifts. I have never killed and I never will kill. This is something horrible, isn't it?" When she looked at a picture of herself in the blue uniform near the camp, which she still keeps in the family album, she said in May of 2004, "This is what gave me the greatest suffering, but also the greatest happiness." She committed suicide in October 2005. So what do we make of Julia? I think there's certainly the question of agency, and I will say right forward, this was her decision to join the camp. She was put on trial because of her participation in the camp, and she was required to carry an actual policy. So there was no involuntary nature to her assignment. But she did not carry out her duties because of an ideological commitment. She was not a party member, even. So why did she then? This is the question I ask. Why would a 19-year-old girl volunteer to be a guard in a Gulag camp? And I think in part because she was not averse to accepting her job, because the camp had been in existence in her town for 10 years. It was, in fact, the main employer. And she was the daughter of a crippled widow, and somehow working there was the only logical choice. And I think that there's no doubt that Julia is a perpetrator. Nor is there much doubt in a legal sense, but also in an everyday sense, that she's guilty. What is more disturbing, I think, is that she, a rank-and-file perpetrator, came to represent an entire repressive legacy and apparatus. And I ask, of course, what of the leadership core? So what did the trial achieve? Its intended moral catharsis? Most likely not. Was it a case of seeking and establishing political legitimacy? Was it a case of expediting justice? I think yes. In addition, we have to consider that the testimony given was done to establish legal exculpation and not so to document historical truth. And it's, I think, the trial of the record is still very important because between 1989 and 2002, the context drastically changed. The emotional and sensitive years of democratic euphoria had been followed by a time of uncertainty and even insecurity. And so at the end, 45 years of communist rule, 100 about Gulag camps were reduced to two guards at a discontinued trial. Thank you.
Thank you. We have almost 15 minutes for questions. The microphone is over there. Hands, please. Nothing controversial has been said. All right.
Martin Mejstřík, já bych měl otázku, nemám před sebou jména, ale poslední přednášející. Kdo v Bulharsku rozhodl o tom, že se nebudou ty komunistické zločiny soudit na základě zločinů proti lidskosti?
We will collect a few questions. There was another hand over there. Could you please raise your hand again over there?
Yeah.
Na konečně tam. And then Professor Kraus, yes.
Já se jmenuji Rudolf Macek a jsem politický vězeň. My se domníváme, že komunisté vyhlásili válku národu a my jsme měli právo proti tomu bojovat. Uvědomte si, že na hranicích uhynulo přes 800 lidí nášlapem na minu, na elektrických drátech a jiný a zastřelený. Komunisté neměli oběti žádné. Buď to ty zemřeli při ožrání a autonehodách, dneska si chtějí stavět pomníky. Bratři Mašinové jsou uznáváni jako hrdinové z naší strany, protože ty vedli válku proti komunistům. My jsme ji vedli taky, skončili jsme v kriminále, odseděli jsme si svá léta. Ale komunisté potrestáni nebyli za vraždy při výsleších a nikdy. Domníváme se, že je to nespravedlivé a vinu nesou lidé, kteří dělali převrat v roce 89.
Tak děkuji, máte pravdu. A pane Kraus. Počkej chvilku. A mikrofon.
I was hoping that each panelist could briefly comment on the state of public opinion. How does German public opinion today assess the way that Germany has come to terms with communist past? What about Polish public opinion? I'd be interested in Bulgarian views as well. Thank you.
Thank you. So shall we start from the left to the right, from Poland to Bulgaria?
Wenn sich aktuelle Lage in Polen handelt, möchte ich Folgendes sagen. Wir führen weiter diese Strafverfahren gegen noch lebenden kommunistischen Täter. Aber finden wir sehr viele formelle Schwierigkeiten, wenn sich auch um Gesundheitszustand der Verdächtigen Personen handelt. Also diese Personen argumentieren, dass wegen Krankheiten und wegen Altern nicht in der Lage sind, bewusst bei Strafverfahren teilzunehmen. Und deswegen müssen
in Polen Staatsanwälte sehr viele Strafverfahren einstellen. Ehrlich zu sagen, meiner Meinung nach konnte man nicht über die neue Verurteilungen zu denken. Natürlich möglich sind einzelne Fälle, aber generell kommen wir zum Schluss, wenn es sich um strafrechtliche Aufarbeitung der kommunistischen Vergangenheit handelt.
Concerning the commissions of inquiry, I don't have the impression that they are as institutions very present in today's memory, but their work is still there because they have established a certain landscape of memory, where the GDR got a place as a dead end. And the anti-totalitarian consensus that was established is excluded this experience from the fundus of experience in the German past that could be claimed in public. So I think that the GDR was profoundly discredited in this sense, and also it's legitimizing historical ideology, anti-fascism, which had been the basis, the historical justification for the state. The commissions of inquiry have established a certain common sense about the GDR past, which seems to me today as part of the democratic consensus in Germany, although this totalitarian view of the German state raised vivid discussions, because many GDR citizens didn't see themselves as citizens of a totalitarian state. They saw themselves as citizens of a welfare state, the welfare state in the GDR form, a state of security, social security, of course. And they didn't see them, that their biographies had been profoundly marked by this totalitarian experience. So there's been a lot of this, and there is still opposition to this totalitarian view of the GDR past by GDR citizens, I think.
Aus meiner Sicht ist es so, dass die Vergangenheit in Deutschland, die DDR gibt es nicht mehr, immer noch gegenwärtig ist. Also die Strafverfolgungsbehörden haben ihre Arbeit erledigt. Da gibt es aus rechtlichen Gründen nichts mehr zu tun. Die Vergangenheit wird weiter bearbeitet in Deutschland durch eine Vielzahl von Veranstaltungen, die über das ganze Jahr verbreitet, in vielen Teilen, überwiegend aber in den ostdeutschen Ländern stattfinden. Gerade das Jahr 89, das Jahr, in dem die Mauer gefallen ist, in dem die friedliche Revolution von den Bürgern der DDR eingeleitet worden ist, ist eine Großveranstaltung. Auf der anderen Seite ist es aber so, dass es noch eine sehr lebhafte Diskussion in Deutschland über die Vergangenheit gibt. Die alten Kräfte in der ehemaligen DDR gewinnen Auftrieb, bedingt dadurch, dass sich die wirtschaftlichen Verhältnisse im gesamten Deutschland und insbesondere in dem Teil Ostdeutschlands nicht so entwickeln und jetzt durch die Finanzkrise wieder einen Rückschlag erhalten haben, wie das mal versprochen worden ist und auch vielfach gesehen worden ist. Der Altbundeskanzler Helmut Kohl hat ja damals davon gesprochen, dass es blühende Landschaften im Osten Deutschlands geben werde. Das Gegenteil ist leider der Fall. Die Menschen verlassen den Osten Deutschlands, insbesondere junge Leute, so wie es zu DDR-Zeiten nicht möglich war, aus wirtschaftlichen Gründen, weil es wenig Arbeitskräfte gibt. Dann haben wir ja auch auf dem politischen Sektor eine sehr interessante Entwicklung. Die SED war die kommunistische Partei Ostdeutschlands. Nach der oder schon vor der Wende hat sie sich einen anderen Namen gegeben. Zunächst hieß sie SED-PDS, Partei Demokratischer Sozialismus, und dann nur noch PDS. Und inzwischen hat sie auch im westlichen Teil Deutschlands Fuß gefasst und heißt Die Linke. Wir hatten ja vor 14 Tagen Wahlen in Deutschland, und diese Partei hat in den ostdeutschen Ländern, in allen fünf ostdeutschen Ländern, die meisten Stimmen bekommen. Mehr als die traditionellen westdeutschen Parteien, die CDU oder die SPD. Also so ist die politische Entwicklung. Und das...
Yes. I'm just going to, just to answer the first question of the gentleman who asked as to why the crimes were not prosecuted as crimes against humanity. Just briefly, when the trial began, or the process of the trial began rather, the criminal code was amended and the limitation of criminal liability went from 20 to 35 years for the murder of two or more persons, but the Bulgarian Grand National Assembly and the Supreme Court gave no interpretation and remained silent, and thus the trial was discontinued. To answer your second question about public opinion today in Bulgaria, I think we need to distinguish perhaps between what professional organizations are doing and what the public at large is doing, and the latter being very difficult to gauge. But I think that people talk about the past selectively in Bulgaria, and they talk about certain elements of the past. For instance, just very recently, in Bulgarian textbooks for school-aged children, there is a little paragraph that was introduced about the camps. On the other hand, a lot of professional organizations have surfaced in the last year and a half to 2 years that have begun to do tremendous work on it. And while I think that the public is generally disinterested, the hope is that these new investigations done by journalists, by people in the media, will stimulate that interest a little bit further.
Thank you very much. Without further ado, we'll just continue to the next panel, also on transitional justice. So let's just play musical chairs quickly and get on. Please, the next panelist, please come and join us.